From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For many months, a huge debate over a small hunt has packed hearing rooms, inspired protests, and exposed cultural rifts in New Hampshire over what it means to live with wildlife. The animal in question is the bobcat, a creature that's not been hunted here since 1989, when its population was said to be dangerously low. But now, after almost 30 years of protection, New Hampshire Fish and Game says the animals have rebounded and that a limited hunt would continue to allow their numbers to grow. But the commission's proposal for 50 annual bobcat permits has sparked an enormous controversy. Opponents argue it's still unclear how many of these elusive animals there really are. Also, they cite the cat's important role in the ecosystem as a predator species, and many say they simply see no reason to kill bobcats. But supporters say the decision should be based on data, not emotion, that bobcat populations are plenty healthy to spare 50 animals, and that, like it or not, hunting is a long-standing tradition here in the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, the bobcat proposal, what it's all about, and the passions it has stirred up in New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests. Joining us from UNH is John Litvitis, wildlife ecology professor at UNH. He worked on a cooperative project with New Hampshire Fish and Game, studying the bobcat's health, population, and movement, and this study is being widely cited now. John, good to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Great to be here.
Also with us in studio, Rick Vanderpoel. He's a wildlife biologist and principal of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England. He studied a variety of wildlife populations across North America. And Rick, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Dan Teague, Hillsborough County Director for the New Hampshire Trappers Association. And Dan Teague, good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Sam Evans Brown, environment reporter for NHPR. He's done a lot of reporting on this proposal. And Sam, thank you for being here as well.
Good to be here, Laura.
Well, I'd love to start with you, Sam. Just back up a little bit, if you could, please. How did we get to where we are now with this proposal for 50 bobcat permits?
So bobcat hunting and trapping was the norm in the Granite State all the way up into the late 1980s, which is when the bounty that was, it used to be that you'd bring in a bobcat pelt and you get a couple bucks for it. That was abolished, and the season on bobcats was closed because there were so few left. It was estimated at the time there were maybe less than 200 cats in the state. And then they basically closed the season and were waiting for the population to rebound. And then in the early 2000s, hunters were coming to the Fish and Game, coming to the department and saying that they were seeing more cats in the woods, they were seeing more tracks, they were seeing more signs of the cats, and they were actually seeing them. And so, hey, maybe we should think about reopening the season. Fish and Game then undertook this study, which, it was actually a series of three studies which concluded last year, but they began in sort of 2009. And with the numbers that they got, they said, we believe that the population is healthy enough that it can sustain this harvest and actually still continue to grow. And that's what led them, to put forward these rules last year and bring us to today.
Well, and we'll ask John in a minute about his numbers. And worth noting, Sam, that Vermont and Maine do allow bobcat hunting.
Yes, and Massachusetts and Quebec. So it's basically everyone all around us.
What kind of a reaction has this proposal received, Sam? When you do stories on this, for example, what kind of feedback do you get?
Well, it's basically, Fish and Game Commission hearings are an affair that usually, you go over to the Fish and Game offices and there's a lot of empty seats. This one, the hearing room in the New Hampshire State House when they had the hearing in Concord, they estimated there were 600 people in attendance. So, it's
600 people.
It's fair to say that of all the issues that I've been watching with Fish and Game in my 10 years as a reporter here, this is the one that by far has had the most public response.
Wow, Dan Teague, why do you think this has touched such a nerve with people?
Well, it's mostly because it's an animal use issue. It's not really directed at the bobcat. This is an opportunity to make the case for animal use. Period. There's a lot of people that, and I understand where they're coming from, that don't want us to utilize the wild resources that we have in any way, shape, or form. That's my take on it.
This proposal, Sam said, as it's packed hearing rooms like never before. Why do you suppose people get so upset about this particular hunt proposal versus, deer or bear or other animals?
It's because the bobcat is recently been seen, although we've been seeing them in the woods for years and years, the population has grown to the point where everybody's seeing them now. And when you see wildlife, it's cool. And people think that we're going to make it so that they don't see them anymore, which is not the case.
Do you think, Dan, that people have a particular affiliation with this animal because it kind of looks like their house cat?
I would think that has something to do with it, the familiarity with, you know, and all the preconceived and emotional aspects that surround the taking of animals. And a lot of it's concentrated on trapping, but this is a hunting season where there are three methods of take. Well, actually two methods. One is by hunting and one's by trapping. And a lot of it is instigated by the misconceptions surrounding trapping.
And we should definitely get into that. But to you, Rick Van De Paul, I want to turn to you too. Why do you think that this has people just packing hearing rooms, as Sam said?
Well, I think there's a really good question as to why they need a trapping and hunting season for a bobcat to begin with. Bobcats are predators. They help keep small mammal populations in check. They do not harm other wildlife or livestock, for example. They do not impact the sort of human condition like some of our other small mammals and medium-sized mammals do. So, you know, what is the exact reason that we need to manage bobcats in this way is a question I hear a lot.
What about bears? Don't they eat small mammals as well? I know they eat mostly, you know, plants, but
yeah, bears are omnivores. They eat a lot of different things.
Sure, yeah.
But in terms of, you know, taking small mammals like mice, voles, and that kind of thing, bobcats are well-known predators to do that. Of course, their principal prey is snowshoe hare, and their populations do affect bobcats when the snowshoe hare population is high. So bobcats respond accordingly. But they're just one of many predators that optimize snowshoe hare populations. And you really, when you look at the numbers of bobcats that are out there, yeah, 1%, maybe less than that in terms of a take of 50 animals per year may not impact the population. But the question really is why. People don't eat bobcats. They don't, you know, perhaps they use their skins, but other than that, there's no good ecological reason for controlling an animal, whereas there is good reason for trapping and hunting other species in this state.
Well, and Dan, I can see you want to jump in. I want to bring John in, though, real quick. And again, John, you did that UNH study that keeps getting cited. So let's get back to those numbers for a minute, since they have in part driven this discussion. What do we know, John, about the health of this bobcat population and how well it has or has not rebounded?
Well, overall, it's an animal that occupies pretty much the entire state. We conducted a variety of approaches to get a handle on their abundance and distribution, and we relied on people reporting their sightings to us, and also hunters were asked to fill out cards during deer hunting season as another method of getting at least distributional data. And from our analysis of those reports, we found that at least 80% of the townships in New Hampshire have bobcats. So that's a pretty sizable chunk of the state.
How do you feel about the arguments that some people make that the population, you know, it's elusive, you think you see the cat, but maybe you didn't. They're hard to pin down, these animals, obviously. How do you feel about the idea that we don't really know that they've recovered enough to justify a hunt, John? What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to get into the justification of the hunt, but the animal is abundant. It's widespread. Every way we looked at it, we came back with the impression that the animal is indeed doing well throughout the state. Individual animals, when we get a roadkill or other nuisance animal that has been dispatched, are all in good condition. They're reproducing consistently, so the population is sound.
Dan, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Okay, this is not about 50, a take of 50 animals is not about controlling the population. These studies, all these studies cited right in the very beginning that little is known about the bobcat in New Hampshire because the season was stopped in 1989. We have information now through these studies and through the small take. We can keep this information flowing on the population, how they're doing. We can gauge their population growth to other known species to find out any correlations between, is the increase in bobcat population directly related to the increase of the wild turkey population? We don't know that, and we'll never will be able to figure that out because we don't have the information dating back to that.
Well,
but we can continue that if we have a season.
I did want to ask you that, John. So to Dan's point, how much would a hunt help researchers like you, John, get the information you need?
Well, if you're talking about a hunt of 50, it wouldn't be much. That type of information is going to be pretty noisy in the context that, as Dan mentioned, there's going to be a couple of methods of harvest, either trapping or hunting. So one of the best ways of understanding where a population is having some consistent method of either counting or sampling the population. And in this case, the population is going to be moving around quite a bit just based on the environment. We're at the northern edge of the Bobcats Range, and there's going to be a lot of variation in year-to-year abundance based on kitten survival to a large degree. When we have a severe winter as we did last year, kitten survival becomes rather modest and the population does decline.
Did you sorry. Go ahead, John. Yeah.
Yeah, 50 trappers will provide some information, but we get a lot more information, a lot actually more sensitive information just from deer hunters reporting their time in the woods and how many bobcats and several other species they saw. And that turns out to be a very useful data set.
Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, John, I agree that populations of bobcat vary from year to year. I brought with me a summary of my snow transect sampling that I've done for the last 20 years. And looking at the number of bobcats and their respective what they call snow track interval, which is the average distance between track sets on a given line transect, it has gone up and has gone down according to a variety of reasons for many years now. This is over the course of, again, 20 years where I've looked at about 289 miles of snow track transects to get a sense of what the population of bobcats are out there. And I just wanted to point out that you know, the numbers in the study that was performed by your students don't quite match up according to what the estimates are relative to the population. I had a question about that. For example, the Fish and Game report cites a female home range average of about 9 square miles and a male home range average of about 32 square miles. Well, if you use the numbers that the study provided of a minimum resident population of 1,100 bobcats in the state, you come up with about one per every 4.6 square miles, according to your students' stated estimate of 5,100 square miles of habitat.
So Rick, getting a little detailed for this conversation, but basically you're questioning whether the abundance is really there.
That is the question.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in real quick, John, and then we'll move to our callers
Yeah. I'll try to walk you through, I think, a commonsensical approach on how we got that number. Rick is right in that we started out with looking at female home range size because among bobcats, the females are quite territorial. There is very little, if any, overlap between their home rangers. That is not the case for male bobcats. So we started out our approach with two study areas where we tracked 18 bobcats and got a very detailed impression of the habitat requirements of an individual bobcat. We then took that information and made a statewide map of habitat suitability for bobcats. Turns out about 5,000 or so square miles of New Hampshire is quite suitable for bobcats. So this is where the math comes in, and we took that estimate of female home ranges and divided that into area of suitable habitat, and we came up with a little over 500, I think it was close to 550 female bobcats.
So that doesn't count males and kittens.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Our math gets a little more elaborate. So we have no reason to believe that the sex ratio is unbalanced. So we assume that there were an equal number of males and females. Again, males are not territorial. They'll overlap each other's home ranges. They'll overlap multiple female home ranges. So we simply times 2 the number of females, and that got us to 1,100. And from that, we used information that Fish and Game provided us of reproductive rate from animals that were killed by cars. And that gave us an estimate of about, I think, another 1,100 kittens born each year to that population.
So this is what biologists do. They sort of take the knowledge of the population, how it reproduces, how it travels, how it doesn't travel in the case of the female as much, and then you make your best guess.
Right.
Let's go to our listeners. Lots of people want to jump in on this conversation. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And going to email first, this is an email from John Harrigan of Colebrook, and all of you know him, longtime North Country writer and a hunter. John says, the bobcat issue is not a hunting versus anti-hunting issue. To argue it that way cheapens the dialogue and is an insult to the many good and thoughtful hunters who are passionately opposed to pursuing this great little animal. Landowners, too, are passionately against this ill-advised hunting and trapping season. Many landowners who now leave their land open to hunting, some of them in control of thousands of acres, have threatened to post their land if the bobcat season goes through. John says neither should the dialogue take place in scientific terms. There is no doubt that the bobcat population can withstand the, quote, harvest, a term John says I hate when used about wildlife, of about 50 animals. The issue is not can, but should. And he concludes by saying the bobcat does not need us presuming to manage it. Like all apex predators, it adjusts its population to fit the availability of prey. It manages itself quite nicely, thank you. John concludes by saying society should back off and leave this little cat alone. Again, that's from John Harrigan, well-known North Country writer, hunter. John, thank you for the email. Couple questions that have come out of this, gentleman. And Sam, to you first. At some of these hearings, from what I understand, people who were passionately opposed to this did say, look, if you go through with this fishing gang, I'm posting my land.
Certainly that was...
Explain how that works.
So a lot of hunters are allowed on to private land sort of under the goodwill of the landowner, and a lot of landowners were basically saying, as my protest to this decision, I'm going to put my land, post it to all hunting as a way to hopefully, you know, send a message to Fish and Game. You know, to what degree that threat is A, something that people would follow through with, and B, something that actually is persuasive to Fish and Game, I think it's totally unclear. John Harrigan actually wrote a column in which he made the argument that argument could be a way that Fish and Game could sort of back out of this, that they could say, you know, we believe that the science is sound, that there's no reason not to do this, but we've had these threats and therefore we shouldn't go through with the season. But, you know, we'll find out tomorrow.
Tomorrow is the vote.
That indeed, at 1 o'clock.
Done by the 11 Fish and Game commissioners?
Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay.
So it's not the department itself. It's the appointed commissioners who make this decision.
Okay. And Dan, I know you want to jump in, and I do want to ask you about the threats, how concerning you think they are. But we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a moment. You can continue to call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, should New Hampshire resume hunting bobcats? That's the proposal before the Fish and Game Commission. They'll be voting on it tomorrow. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. Again, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests helping us out with this topic today. John Litvitis, wildlife ecology professor at UNH. He worked on a project with New Hampshire Fish and Game, studying the bobcat's health, population, movement. Also with us, Rick Vandepol, wildlife biologist, principal of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England, Dan Teague, Hillsborough County Director for the New Hampshire Trappers Association, and Sam Evans Brown, environment reporter for NHPR. And all of you, before we go back to the phones, I did want to give you a chance, Dan Teague, to jump in on this idea that people who are passionately opposed to the resumption of this hunt say, okay, Fish and Game, if you do this, I'm closing my land to hunting for everybody. How real do you think these threats are?
Well, hopefully they're not that real. It's very disturbing to think about it. It's basically landowners, and they do have their rights and the property to blackmail the commission into acquiescing to their wishes. I don't think that's a very good road for Fish and Game to go down. It could be a long road downhill all the way. The statement that the predators that will control their own populations very nicely is a neat theory, but I don't know how we would know that.
This is related to John's email. Yeah.
Correct. Without the information to back it up. The trophic cascade doesn't apply to our non-wilderness environment without the true apex predators, which are wolves.
What's the trophic cascade? Is that what you said?
Yes. That's a theory that the large predators will control their own numbers when basically it's prey that controls their numbers. It might work in a wilderness setting, but we don't. And our large herbivores are not already controlled by the real apex predator, which is us.
So we've already sort of messed with the laws of nature so much that you're saying that's not as applicable as maybe it was in a pure environment?
I guess so. I don't think messed with. I believe we are filling our proper place in the environment.
What do you think about this idea of people saying, you know what, I'm just posting my land no hunting. I'm so upset about this.
Yeah, I think that's an unfortunate conclusion from this debate. I grew up hunting and trapping. I understand the rights of private property owners to do their own posting, and I've actually done so myself relative to dogs that do not seem to be as in control when hunters use dogs to hunt their animals. That said, I think more of the issue is whether or not, again, bobcats really need to be managed in this way. There, as Dan said, there's really no proof that the trophic cascade, so-called, is operational here in a non-wilderness environment. And I'm not so certain that, again, as a predator, that this is one that really needs to be actively engaged with in a hunting or trapping fashion.
So even though you feel pretty strongly this hunt should not go forward, you don't like the idea of people making that threat that I'll post my land no hunting if you go ahead with this fishing game?
Absolutely not.
Sam, real quick, and then we'll go back to our listeners.
Yeah, just to give some context as to why that threat is perhaps so menacing is that, you know, over the years, more and more landowners have been posting their land for reasons totally unrelated to this bobcat debate. And that's an issue that Fish and Game has been confronting for a couple decades now, and perhaps why that threat was leveraged. You know, it's one that they know that Fish and Game doesn't like to hear.
Let's go to our listeners again. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dan is calling in from Concord. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually participated in the Bobcat Trail Camera study 2 years ago, the results of which, you know, were used to propose this season. I'm an avid hunter. If this season goes through, I will not participate because I only kill what I'm going to eat, and I haven't been desperate enough yet to want to eat a predator. But I think this exposes this whole debate over the bobcat season exposes the larger issue, which is how do we fund Fish and Game adequately going forward, and who are our constituents? Are they just the hook and bullet crowd, or are they the, quote, non-consumptive wildlife user? And if so, how do we meet all those needs financially?
Well, and again, I know what you're talking about, Dan, but fill us in a little bit more, you know, the idea that Fish and Game is funded by hunting and fishing licenses, and so those folks pay the bills. So go ahead, Dan.
Yes,
you still there? Yeah,
yes,
give us a little bit more there. I know what you're talking about, but yeah.
Well, okay. So I mean, you know, for decades, hunters, anglers, and trappers have been putting their money where their mouth is, and then the proceeds from hunting licenses and everything have gone to benefit not only game species but non-game species. And there's been recent efforts to try and get other users of wildlife in on the game. The moose plate is an example of that, and I think that there's two ways fish and game can go. They can make their tent smaller and just cater to the hunting and fishing and trapping community and stop rescuing hikers and all that stuff, in which case their funds are going to get smaller and smaller because across all demographics, except I think with women, hunters are declining. Or they can make their tent bigger and welcome the non-consumptive wildlife users and possibly have things like fees for kayaking and canoeing and hiking and wildlife watching, and if we do that, those people deserve a seat at the policy-making table as well, and that might not sit well with some hunters who feel that that may be an in for the animal rights community, who, by the way, it's interesting that they pick their battles, too. I testified in the legislature last week on a bill to ban winter feeding of deer because Fish and Game has said for years it's detrimental to them, to their health, and I was there in favor of that bill, and members of Fish and Game were there in favor of that bill, but no members from the animal rights community were there in favor of that bill. So I think they certainly picked their battles, too, and they're somewhat politically motivated as well.
Okay, Dan, well, good to hear from you on this. And I did want to turn to all of you on this. This is a huge issue. The Fish and Game Commission itself, how it's structured, who is on it. Our caller is absolutely right. Fish and Game gets most of its money from hunting and fishing licenses. And I guess I'll turn to you first, Dan Teague. So people say this skews the decision-making that Fish and Game makes. What do you think about that?
Well, I can see how you could see it that way. I don't believe that it skews it in any way, shape, or form. These are people that are invested in the wildlife of the state of New Hampshire and the perpetuation of the heritage that we all love and enjoy, the heritage of hunting, fishing, and trapping. We should be represented on that board more than people that don't pay in. They don't. They're not as involved. I guess that's all I have to say about that. The commission is the commission. They represent us, those who are invested.
We've done multiple shows on this, Sam. The idea that, Fish and Game does a lot more than just, what did our caller call it? The hook and bullet crowd. Conservation, habitat management.
Law enforcement.
Finding the people who get lost in the woods. So I would love to get your thoughts on how this whole bobcat debate sort of broadens to this bigger issue of what Fish and Game is, does, and what perhaps it should be.
Well, so I think what he's getting at, the caller's getting at, is that a big complaint from the animal rights community has been that in order to be a fish and game commissioner, you have to hold a hunting license. And basically what they're saying is that this is a department that's by hunters for hunters and is not considering our concerns as fully as we would like them to. They'd like to see a reform that would make it so that non-hunters could hold a seat on the commission so that, as the caller put it, non-consumptive uses, which we're talking about, passive recreation hikers, bird watchers, et cetera, might wind up on the Fish and Game Commission. You might have more of a variety of viewpoints. But as the caller points out, those users are not paying the fees that fund Fish and Game and make their work possible.
They don't chip in. And every time you talk about a kayak tax, people go crazy.
They go totally crazy. And the idea, imagine if you were to have, a toll at the start of every hiking trail that you had to put in to fund Fish and Game in order to hike the trail. Imagine the outcry you'd have over that.
So go ahead.
And just a real quick point on the money front. Another issue here is that this is not some folks have pointed to this as a way that Fish and Game is hoping to make money. This is not a money maker. They've estimated the bobcat hunt could cost them as much as $20,000 to administer, and they get maybe $5,000 in license fees. So this is definitely not a revenue source for them. They're seeing this as part of their mission that they're trying to fulfill to allow the use of wildlife, and when we say use, what we're talking about is trapping and hunting.
So even though this particular bobcat hunt, Sam, is not a moneymaker, as some people charge, it does raise, as our caller suggests, this broader issue of who Fish and Game represents and who funds Fish and Game.
And certainly lots of people are talking about that. We might see some proposals to make some changes in perhaps next year's legislative session, but it's an open question as to how much appetite there is for engaging in that deep of a reform.
Okay, so Rick, I'm going to go to you, and then John, one last question for you. Go ahead, Rick.
I think we need a new sort of paradigm for wildlife management in this state. I don't believe the current way in which we oversee our wildlife resources is adequate. I don't think the way that we operate our research and conduct our research is sufficient, nor, given the conditions that are changing on the global scale, are we adequately prepared to provide comprehensive oversight in stewarding our natural resources, which, of course, gets at the mission of fish and game. Elected representatives on the commission, if they were representative of a complete constituency who supported wildlife in the state, absolutely. I understand the dilemma when fish and game licenses certainly fund most of this work. However, I might suggest as well that federal dollars also fund a lot of fish and game's work, and those dollars are not necessarily subject to the whims of New Hampshire residents. So I think we have to relook at the entire suite of funding sources and what the actual mission of the department is.
Well, one last question for you, John Litvitas, again, as our biologist. We mentioned earlier that Vermont and Maine and many other states continued their bobcat hunts while New Hampshire got rid of its for almost 30 years. What is it about Vermont and Maine, for example, John, their environment or their bobcat populations that's different that allowed those states to continue with their hunt?
I don't know if there's any one thing. Perhaps land use is probably the biggest one. One of your guests mentioned the reliance of bobcats on snowshoe hare, but New Hampshire was probably just as important for New England cottontail to be on the landscape for bobcats, and their populations have nosedived to the point of nearly being listed as threatened and endangered. So are land use patterns perhaps less cutting of forest than folks over in Maine, less farmland than over in Vermont? You know, the mix of land uses is often good to a number of prey species and as a result good for bobcats. We had the added whammy, but so did those other states, of the arrival of coyotes that compete with bobcats from time to time for the limited prey resource. So there really wasn't one thing that drove our populations down. There was a variety of factors, and we chose to close the season, whereas those other states responded with a shortening of their seasons to a large degree.
Well, John, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
I hope I didn't take it into the weeds too deep.
Nope, you didn't. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot.
John Litvitas, wildlife ecology professor at UNH. Again, he worked on a cooperative project with Fish and Game studying bobcat populations here in New Hampshire. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Barbara's calling in from Roxbury. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. I have had the unfortunate experience of having my dog caught in a steel trap, and I am vehemently opposed to trapping. I'm not against hunters. I realize the need for hunting in New Hampshire. I'm not a hunter myself. But I ended up, I was out riding my horse. My dog always goes with me, and I'm riding along. And all of a sudden, the dog is screaming, and I hop off the horse, and he's caught in a steel trap. I can't get him out. I can't open the trap. Maybe there was a release. I just was frantic, and I had no idea how to open it. So I had no other choice but to, and I was by myself. I was totally, not where there were any people. I ended up riding about a quarter mile up to a highway, got off the horse, and was frantically waving my blaze orange vest, trying to get somebody to stop and help me. Finally, somebody did. They came down, and we were able to get the dog out of the trap. Fortunately, the leg was not broken, but he was three-legged lame, and I was about a mile from home still at this point, and so I had to ride back with him hopping all the way back. I was fortunate not to lose the dog.
Wow. Well, Barbara, what a good Samaritan to help you out that way. And
oh,
that's quite
God.
A story.
And
I do have a quick question for you, though. So obviously opposed to the trap. What about hunting bobcats with firearms?
Well, Like I said, I'm not opposed to hunting, but I don't think there's a need for hunting them at this stage of the game. I don't think the population is big enough.
Okay.
I live in an area where there's tons of deer, and I realize that there's a need to reduce the population. I know there's been sightings of bobcats, you know, in my area, but not enough to cause concern where I feel like it's a going to be an issue. I don't
okay.
think
Barbara, I'll let you go because I do want to get our guests in. And thank you so much for this story. And, you know, we've talked already about whether the population is rebounded enough or not. Lots of debate around that. But I think to you first, Dan Teague, you do hear this concern from people about trapping especially. Do you think that that's the problem for some folks, the trapping, or is it overall the bobcat hunt, the idea of hunting it no matter which method is used?
I think both issues are very important to everybody. I do believe that the trapping is one of the big sticking points. It's very unfortunate that her dog was caught in a trap. That her dog's leg wasn't broken is not surprising. I'm sure if that trap was a legally set trap, that the person who set the trap had written permission from the landowner to have it there. Written permission. Trapping requires written permission. Your dog didn't obtain written permission. Your horse and you didn't obtain written permission. So, you know, that's I feel bad for that. But I do believe trapping has a lot to do with the fact that some of the outcry for the bobcat season is in regards to that.
Would a good compromise be, what do you think, Dan, to do the hunt just by firearm and get rid of the trapping component? Because people do seem to have, that's just based on the feedback that I've seen, you know, out there in social media or in the newspapers or whatever, that seems to be an issue that people are keying in on.
The only effective method for hunting predators are nocturnal living fur bears in this state is through either hunting them with hounds, which the dog can find them day or night, whatever, or through trapping. Trapping is the only effective method for the harvesting of, or the taking, however you want to say it, of our nocturnal fur bears. They're not a diurnal animal. They're not out during the day.
I see.
We're seeing them out during the day is just one of the evidences that the population has done so well. The studies concentrated on optimum home ranges. We are seeing a lot of evidence of cats living in outside of these optimum home ranges, which is prima facie evidence of a greater population than what the studies say.
Okay, again, getting back to that question of how robust the population is.
Correct.
But in terms of hunting the animal, if you were going to hunt it at night when it's out and about, you'd have to be walking around the woods.
That's also illegal.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Barbara. We'll follow up a little bit more after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, should New Hampshire resume hunting of bobcats? Bobcat hunting has been banned since 1989, but now there's a proposal before the Fish and Game Department that will be voted on tomorrow as to whether a hunt should be resumed. A small hunt of 50 permits. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sam Evans-Brown, Dan Teague, Rick Van de Paul, let's go right back to our listeners. And Chris is joining us from Wentworth. Hi, Chris. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm definitely a proponent for the bobcat hunting season. I grew up hunting and fishing in New Hampshire. I'm 41 years old, and I'm actually a professional hunter. I hunt all over the country. I have a national hunting TV show, and I'm able to live in the great state of New Hampshire. And our Fish and Game office, they do a great job. I've actually worked with them extensively on different things, from turkeys and seminars and all the great things they do. And this basically comes down to just common sense. I mean, when Fish and Game stood up when the bobcat population was low and they stopped the hunting season, population has definitely increased. I've had many more trail camera pictures and seen many more bobcats in the woods in the last few years. And now they've decided, through all their studies, that there is enough bobcats to reintroduce it. So I think, you know, a lot of people go on feelings instead of facts, and Fish and Game uses facts. And they do a great job. You know, hunting and fishing does pay for Fish and Game, but a lot of the hunters, you know, think that Fish and Game doesn't have, deer harvest like they would like. Fish and Game works for the animals. They don't work for the hunters. they get paid by the licenses, and that's great. And like they said before, you know, the guys going out hiking and bird watching and stuff, they don't really pay. To go on one of the facts, I'm also a selectman in a small town, and that current use issue, that the threat of current use, what people have to understand there, too, is there is two current uses in the state of New Hampshire, and they're different values. One current use is where you can post your land, and the more open current use, which saves you 20% more in taxes,
right,
to have people hunt.
Open space is taxed at a lower rate. You know, just
right.
I'm very interested in the fact that you host a hunting show, that you really trust Fish and Game. You think they've done due diligence on this. I did want to ask you a question, Chris. We talked a minute ago about the firearm hunting versus trapping. Dan explained that really trapping is the best method for catching these animals. I do wonder what you think, though, as a proponent of the bobcat hunt. Would a compromise be not allowing the trapping? That seems to be where a lot of people are getting caught up.
No, you know, I don't think so. I mean, hunting is a heritage that we've all grown up doing. I did it with my grandfather. There's no reason that the trapping should be taken out. It actually is a pretty humane way to get some animals, especially animals that are, you know, elusive, and hunting them with rifles, and I do a lot of bow hunting and stuff, and it's very hard to hunt a predator. I mean, sometimes you can use calls and things like that, but, you know, it's very hard. And the trapping, if they've deemed that they need to take 50%, the trapping is an easier way because you get to set the trap out. You don't have to be there the whole time. Now, mind you, there's so many rules on trapping now, too. People have to check their traps every day. They check their trap lines. Like they had said before, you know, they need written permission to be there. The lady called in about her dog. I mean, unfortunately, it sounds like she was probably on somebody else's land, and somebody had permission to be there. Fish and Game knows where these trapping sites are, and there's due diligence all around. So I think the firearms, you know, you'll get a few. You'll get some here and there. But I think trapping is still a great way to use and utilize harvesting some of these animals.
Okay. Well, Chris, good to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Rick, what do you think about his comment, this decision should be based on facts instead of feelings? That's an accusation that the pro-bobcat hunting folks have made, that this is all emotion because, you know, these are beautiful animals that look like our house cats. But the facts are that the population is healthy and we should go ahead.
I'm not so sure of those facts. Yes, the population of bobcats have grown. They've increased over the last 10 or 15 years. But my question at the State House the other day was, has it grown sufficiently where we are able to do so without further impacting a population that's just getting back on its feet? And that's a question that I'm not sure Fish and Game and nor Dr. Lidvitas can actually answer at this point in time. Second point on that would be simply that, again, bobcats are predators. Why trap them when you do not use their skin other than for pelt? You do not eat bobcats. What exactly are you doing that supports that traditional trapping of an animal in doing so? Why would you do that?
Chris, thank you for the call. Let's take another one from Nashua. Hi, Guy. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate the conversation. And I'd like to just support some comments that were just made. First of all, I'm a gun owner, and I do feel, and I'm from New Hampshire, I do feel as if the trapping process is extremely inhumane and very cruel. If you're going to kill an animal, kill it, put it out of its misery, but do not leave it in a trap. I don't care if they check it once a day. How many hours has that animal been stuck in a trap? So if it were my dog that got stuck in a trap, I would have been furious. I think the previous caller was actually pretty calm about the whole thing and the way she handled it. But further, I want to ask this question. Out in the western United States, my understanding is that part of the role of Fish and Game and wildlife is to manage populations. And we've already talked about that from one perspective, but I didn't hear it from the other. So, for example, is the bobcat, the population of bobcat, is actually causing a decrease, significant decrease to another in their balance of the ecosystem? Are they actually cutting into severely impacting another population of another animal? Because it's not about just the bobcat's population. It's about what they're impacting on other populations. So in my mind, the role of this institution in issuing licenses and permitting hunting is to manage the populations all the way around. So if they're not adversely affecting another population, why do we need to kill them? I mean, if it's a sport, I don't consider trapping a sport. To me, and it's not an emotional thing. It's just not. What's the challenge in it? You've actually set up something the animal can't see. They get stuck. They suffer for who knows how long before they're actually put out of their misery.
And Guy, you're saying this as a hunter yourself, but a hunter with firearms.
Yeah, I mean, again, based on, is this bobcat population causing a significant impact on another type of animal that needs to be kept in balance so they're not population that diminished?
Okay.
Or you could even look at it from the standpoint, is the bobcat starving because they don't have enough food to survive on?
Guy,
Those are the two key issues.
Yeah, thank you for calling in. And, boy, lots of comments, lots of thoughts, lots of calls. Who wants to go first? How about you, Dan Teague?
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
As to the humaneness, let's talk about the whether they're impacting any other creatures in their ecosystem. How do we know? It's impossible to know without the information. The thoughts that the population estimates may be too high, they may be, or maybe not. Maybe there's 4,000 cats in this state. There's no way of knowing this. If you compare this study to the study that was done in Iowa, the Iowa bobcat was on the threatened list until 2003. They removed it from the list. They opened a season in 2007, 150 animals. They estimated their population was very similar to ours. Now, today, they're taking 450 cats. They've opened up almost half the state. The numbers are just the numbers. They're estimates. No one can know exactly. And until we get our fingers on it, 300 bobcats were necropsied by Pat Tate, our fur bear biologist, from 2007 until now. It's over 30 a year. The average age was 2.5 years old. Now, these cats are being hit on the road in non-optimal places. 2.5 years old, that's the age what they're out moving around looking for their own territories, the females. So we need to know. This is information that we need to know.
Thank you for the call, Guy. Let's go to Wolfboro, where Reeve is on the line. Hi, Reeve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hey, I'll try to be quick. I've got a couple comments. First of all, I think that we really need a reason to kill something before we decide to kill it. And I really, this argument is, this conversation today, which has been excellent, has persuaded me that we do not need the bobcat kill. And I especially lean on the side of all the hunters who are opposed to it. But to another point that you keep referring to the data regarding all of this, and no one has mentioned that one of the foods of a bobcat is mice. And mice are one of the primary vectors for carrying deer ticks to houses and humans. I personally think we ought to let the bobcat explode, and you know, until I see them patrolling my yard, I would love that.
Well,
we lead the nation in Lyme disease, so if for no other reason, I think it would be silly to take them until they are, you know, really like everywhere.
Well, and Sam, this relates to Guy's question too about the impact of the bobcat on other species. I also have an email from David who kind of asks what Reeve asks, who says New Hampshire Fish and Game fails to connect how the hunting of these bobcats affects other programs agencies involved in. For example, David also says bobcat eat mice, raccoons, skunks, and other small species. Do these animals carry ticks that impact moose or ticks that carry Lyme disease? Where is the landscape level biology analysis? So David and Reeve kind of asking the same question there, Sam. What have you heard about this?
Certainly, again, this has been a talking point that the anti-bobcat trapping crowd has used, that you know, Lyme disease is a problem. Bobcats eat mice. Mice carry Lyme disease. I think we don't really have any evidence that bobcats are a major control, you know, way of controlling varmint populations that would then decrease the prevalence of Lyme disease. I think it's that's a pretty far stretch to make that argument. I mean, deer tick obviously are on deer, and there are a lot of deer as well, and bobcats are not controlling that population. So you know, it's something that people have been saying. I don't see any evidence that is the case.
What do you think, Rick, on this idea? I have heard this a lot, that we should let bobcats proliferate because they do control the rodent population.
Yeah, well, that's in part true, but not completely true. We've got a lot of predators that control the small mammal population. And over the last several years, for my live trapping efforts, I've noticed that the small mammal population has actually increased in spite of the increase of a lot of our predators. So that's – and that's not – too surprising, given the kind of climatic conditions we've had, mild winters, et cetera, food sources. But no, I don't think there's any evidence of that. I don't think that's a reasonable rationale.
All right. Well, thank you, Ree, for the call. And here's an email from Jennifer who says, personally, I wouldn't mind seeing the population go down. This past fall, we saw bobcats all around our property during the day, which was extremely unusual. And my Maine Coon cat would go out at night and get into standoffs with them. Unfortunately, Jennifer says, it seems he must have lost a fight with one of them. One night he went out and never came home. Consider me vindictive, but I'd be happy not to see them around so much. Now, Jennifer didn't say where she lives. That would be interesting to see what part of the state she lives in. And then here's one from Carlene who says, I live in an area where I'm fortunate to see lots of wildlife. Deer, moose, bear, coyote, fisher, turkeys, snowshoe hare, etc. So what I haven't seen in over 40 years of living in New Hampshire, bobcat, Carlene says, and I do look. Thank you both for those emails. Again, the phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. Sam, getting back to the Fish and Game Commission, how it's structured, whether there should be a non-hunting or fishing name on that commission, just remind us what happens with this proposal. The 11 commissioners sit down tomorrow, and then what?
Well, if they voted in, then the season will take effect next December. There'll be I believe it's trapping season first, and then rifle firearm hunting season with hounds, as Dan said, will follow in January. If they vote it down, I mean, this is one of these things though that they can make changes and they can put them forth tomorrow. So how they have taken the public's input and integrated that into the decision, we won't know until we see what they're bringing forth. So, I mean, really, you just got to show up to the hearing.
Could hunters legitimately say, Dan, look, public input, that's great, but, you know, the hunters and fishermen are the ones who are paying the bills, so.
That is correct. We are the ones that are paying the bills. We are not as well-funded. We are not as well-organized. We don't have that which the anti-use establishment has. We are few in number compared to the anti-use organizations. The Fish and Game Commission has a mandate to promote hunting, fishing, and trapping. Right in there, the RSA that identifies them as a board. And this is very nervous.
You're doing fine.
So
it's a long-standing issue.
It is a long-standing
issue. Who pays in and who benefits.
And it's very important that we recognize the good job that the Fish and Game has done at maintaining populations below the carrying capacity of the land, which is where the population should be, which is one of the big gripes by especially deer hunters in this state, because we don't have deer hunting like in Pennsylvania, in states like that. But they are managing our wild resources for the wildlife, not for us, not for the users.
Which is what one of our callers brought up. I think it was
correct.
Chris. So it's interesting, Rick. So in a way, we're talking about something small, 50 permits, but in a way, we're talking about something big.
Huge.
Very big. We have 9 species that are regularly trapped. We have good records for them going decades into the past. And again, I question the need to trap bobcats at all, and certainly at this time when the numbers are not really tight in terms of their population base. Trapping as a tradition can go on with a large number of other species that perhaps do need some management given the fragmented habitats we're living within. But bobcats, I don't see the need for it, and I still haven't seen a good rationale for that.
So you're not opposed to hunting or trapping?
No. Like I said,
which some of our callers have said.
I grew up trapping and hunting. I understand. Gardens I had to protect. I understand that. That said, you know, if in terms of hunting, using all of the animal, that should be a basis for supporting that as well.
Go ahead.
If we had information on the population trends of bobcats to compare side by side with all the other animals that we trap and harvest in the state of New Hampshire, we could have some really good information on whether they are actually impacting other species. We don't have that. We have the opportunity to start, and that's what we should do.
Sam, anybody making predictions about how these commissioners are going to vote tomorrow?
I'm out of the prediction game, Laura. I think
there's no polls like we have with the elections.
Yeah,
right?
and it's just 11 guys who are sort of alone with their consciences on this one after hearing a mountain of feedback. So we'll just have to see what they do.
Well, I want to thank everybody who gave us their feedback today. It was good to hear from everyone, and I want to thank the three of you for coming in. Sam Evans-Brown, you're always helping us out. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. Dan Teague, good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Dan Teague, Hillsborough County Director for the New Hampshire Trappers Association. And Rick VandePaul, good to meet you, too. Thank you.
Good, Laura. Thank you.
Rick VandePaul, wildlife biologist, principal of Ecosystem Management Consultants of New England. This is The Exchange on NHPR.